All right. Welcome to Radiant Creators. Thank you so much for being on, Michael Miracle. So I'm going to read a little bit of your bio here, just so people know who we're talking to. And that sound in the background, that's my chihuahua coughing, if anybody hears that. So whether it be on the piano, in the studio, on the stage, or on the dance floor, Michael Miracle has been devoted to creating beautiful music with purpose. Michael has toured with West Coast bands, played in electronic music groups from San Fran to Seattle, and has composed music for films, commercials, and modern dance performances. He also composes hemi-sync music for the Monroe Institute, creating binaural beat music for focus, creativity, and learning. Michael has released 9 albums since the year 2000. These albums reflect a variety of musical styles, I almost said mystical, including electronic, down-tempo, pop, ambient, neoclassical, instrumental piano, and up-tempo dance music. His sweetly crafted melodic sounds take the listener through transcendent worlds of imagination, emotion, and stillness. So, Michael, thanks so much for being on the show. It looks like you're in your studio.
Yes, I am, and I covered up all the clutter with these nice shades.
Yeah, it's always nice to be able to do that. One of the things that I have been working on for years but have not accomplished yet is a single place where I do interviews. That would be the most perfect thing if you always had it set up and ready. But that's a level of, I guess, discipline and togetherness I have not quite, you know, lined up yet. So, so one of the things that... But where I kind of came across your work initially was this breakthrough, hemi-sync. And well, first of all, like, what did I miss in your bio that people should know about you? And then we'll talk about this. Then we'll talk about other things.
Okay. Oh, there's a lot of things.
Yeah.
So we'll get back to the breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But actually, here's one. You know, what's it like to be, you've been doing this since 2000, but that's not where it started. So I would say, when did music start for you?
Right. Yeah. It started when I was 4 years old. My mom and dad purchased the piano, and one of my earliest memories was I went right up to the piano and started making music on the black keys. And it felt familiar. It was just really easy. And it just kind of all that very first time I sat at the piano, I just started creating music.
Wow. And so
it was on the black keys.
Black keys.
Yeah, I don't know if you know this, but you can't really play a wrong note on the black keys. Like it's a pentatonic scale, so it always sounds good. And it's, yeah, that's kind of where I started.
Right on the there. Black keys.
Yeah.
Wow, I like that. And then I guess the white keys came later.
yes, where it's had to learn about harmony and theory and all that. And that's actually been a lifelong journey.
Wow.
And it is.
And from piano, so just the black keys, that's quite interesting, where as 4 years old, you took to the keyboard, which is, you know, a lot of kids will, when you go to the keyboard and they'll start to, you know, kind of bang on it, but to actually use the individual fingers and begin to actually play something, does it seem like that's probably a skill you came in with? Because most that's uncommon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I think it's something that, you know, if we're living across many lifetimes, it's something that I brought with me, because it just, I can hear it. You know, I can hear music. That's a conversation we can go really deep into if you want. But it's something that I've, you know, worked on my whole life, and at the core, it's just this music that just comes through me. you know,
comes through. Yeah. Because, and so when you mentioned hearing music, that's something definitely worth going into. I mean, so when you say that you really hear music, define that. I know it's probably difficult to define possibly, but when you say that you really hear music, what are you hearing? Or is that way too open-ended?
Just tapping into the something that I learned. When I lived in Seattle, I was playing piano for ballet classes and modern dance classes for about 8 years. And I got really good at it. And quickly I realized I was actually getting paid to study piano because I was just getting better and better at piano. And I would have to play for these classes that were usually about an hour and a half long. And usually two classes a day. So I had to play piano for 3 hours straight every day. And I was just improvising the whole time, and I was just getting better and better at it. And I started to realize I could just tap into this universal creativity that was just available anytime. And you know, it would start to get overwhelming if I tried to record it all the time, because then I would just have like hours and hours of recordings that just, you know, what am I going to do with all this? You know, how can I like put this into a form where people can listen to it anytime? And, but it's, you know, it's literally hundreds of hours of recording. So sometimes I just would let the universe have it, just play. Yeah. And, but that's kind of what I'm saying. Like, just, I can hear it, and it's not like I can just tap in immediately. I can, but you have to warm up too. I have to warm up, you know, for like an hour or so. And once I start playing for about an hour, I can really just drop in and let it just blow through me.
And what year was that, or what years?
Oh, in Seattle?
Yeah.
Well, I got to Seattle in 2001, and I kind of, I wasn't, it's a long, crazy story, but I wasn't really doing music for a long time. For about 18 years, I was just kind of floating around and struggling and trying to find myself and working really menial jobs and just struggling. And I was in the Bay Area and I just failed. Life just kind of was too much for me there. And I had to leave. And so I kind of regrouped and I went to Seattle, and a colleague from college that I went to school with and studied composition, he was the music director at the, for the Department of Dance at the University of Washington. And early on, he was like, "Oh, come play for dance classes. Come try it out." And I was like, no, no, thanks. I can't do that. And then finally, in 2010, it took me about 9 years to finally say yes. I went in and I started playing for dance classes. And I started in 2010 doing that. And
wow. And that was in Seattle. Yeah. So, well, it's... Yeah, you probably were in San Francisco. It wouldn't take this a lot of different ways, but, you know, probably the end of its best years, you know, if you left about by 2000. I mean, I always love San Francisco as well. And I think that, like, its height probably ended about 2000. It lasted after that, too. And I mean, it's still a great city, but... There's a very different San Francisco, I think, pre 2000 and after 2000, and you know.
So live there or?
No, I never lived there, but I lived in Ventura and Pasadena, California, for like a decade, and it was a couple hours drive, but certainly would go up to San Francisco and spend time up there, but I did live in Seattle as well. For like, gosh, I don't know, 6-8 years. I forget how long, but quite a while. And moved to Phoenix, like, gosh, 7 years ago, I think now. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, definitely magical cities, you know. And and so, with your playing, so did you, so you started with the Black Keys, you know, which would be a great, which would be a great song title, Black Keys, just would be, you know, did you do formal training or is it really autodidactic? I mean, how did you get from Black Keys to your, you know, 3 hours of playing a day?
Right. Yeah, I had formal training. Once I was when I first started, we lived in LA, and then my parents moved us up to the Central Coast, this little town called Los Osos, which means the Bears. And I started taking piano lessons around age six, and my piano teacher, who actually had the same birthday as me, she was very patient with me because I would sometimes practice my Mozart, but mostly I just like to create music. My dad had this Beatles book, like all the Beatles songs, like in a book. It was for guitar, but I could see the chords, and that's how I started learning how to play chords. I would see the chord and figure it out on the piano. And what I did was I would just read the chords of a Beatles song, and I would make up my own music to it. Like I would make my own song. And I didn't even know what Beatles song it was, but it just kind of was one way that I was having fun with music. I think, you know, part of music is it has to be fun. You know, if you're not having fun, you're not going to play, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's so important. So I think where many people get frustrated in learning music, whatever they're learning to play, it's that one of the standard ways of learning is you're playing what's already been done, you might say, which is great. I mean, there's many things you're going to want to learn how to play because you're just interested in that. You like the sound. You like to explore that. I mean, I think that learning to play specific, you know, music, like, you know, if you're learning to play like Jimi Hendrix on the guitar, and just you get to understand Jimi Hendrix that way, in a sense, and on a certain level, you can be kind of playing what he was playing, and you almost call that like channeling. You can connect to like the, you know, Hendrix energy, and you can. So I think it's, you know, it's a way you can understand, let's say, who Jimi Hendrix was, like in no other way, like can one quite experience, let's say, Jimi Hendrix like that, as actually, you know, playing his music. And it's fine if a person doesn't, if they just listen to it. But if you play it, that's a whole unique level that, you know, and I'm sure people who don't have an interest in that level of communication, I don't mean level as in higher or lower, but that frequency of communication, they're just not going to be playing an instrument anyway, or not playing Hendrix. They'll be doing something else. So like you mentioned Mozart, you know, it's like, I mean, you want to get to know Mozart, you know, play Mozart on the piano, and you're going to really get to know Mozart, you know, who was this guy, you know? So, and you got from, so was that really a big, you could say, breakthrough in like 2010 or so, when you were in Seattle and you were, you know, playing those 3 hours a day? Was that your first recording of yourself? No.
It was a big breakthrough for me because I was just sort of floating around through life. I had had some success here and there. That album Breakthrough that you have was the first release that I had. Well, it was the second, but it was the first release with the label, and I was actually getting a little paycheck twice a year. Not little. It was a nice amount at the time. And so that was a nice little success to have gotten there. But in 2010, we had just gotten married, and she was saying, well, why aren't you doing music? Why are you just doing this over here, this job? Why you need to go do that? You need to go play for that dance class. You need to do it. So she kind of pushed me. She does that a lot, but she pushed me into that job. And it was just, totally changed my life.
And so Breakthrough was recorded before 2010.
It was. Some of it was recorded in San Francisco when I lived there, some of the songs. Oh my gosh, one of the songs was recorded in Santa Barbara.
Really?
Yeah. Yep. I don't even, they do have titles. I don't think that Breakthrough has the titles on there. But if you go to my Bandcamp page, you can see some of the songs are on a song or an album that I released in 2000, which is called Dream Melodia. Some of those Breakthrough songs are on there. But I don't know if I gave you a link to my Bandcamp page.
Let's see, I've got the, oh, Bandcamp. I do, yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know, I'll actually just cause I will, I'll share that because you've got a lot of content online, which is very cool. So there's, put that over there. Okay. So here's your Bandcamp page, and I'll put all these links. I mean, of course, you can find all of Michael's stuff. You can start at michaelmiracle.com, and it's all there. But I'll put links to everything in the show notes as well. And so you've got the actual track titles here.
Yes. So Dream Melodia was my first release in the year 2000. And some of the songs on there made it over to that Breakthrough album. Spiderweb.
Mm.
I believe another one or two. Maybe I can't quite see what it says, but I guess not.
Yeah.
Spiderweb is. But what were we talking about?
just some of the Breakthrough tracks, you know. Because, the tracks aren't on the actual Breakthrough CD. Yes. And
they were recorded over a span of about 1995 to 2000, 2001.
So it's kind of the California Breakthrough album.
Yeah. Here we go.
Yeah.
When I moved to Seattle, I met some people that were hooked in with the Monroe Institute, and they said, "Hey, do you want to do a song for a compilation?" And I said, "I'll do a whole album if you want."
They ended up
liking that, and that I did. I think I did. I just did two albums with them, but
It was Breakthrough, and the other one was, I might even have it here somewhere. I think I do, but I know one was Breakthrough, of course, and this is the CD here people can see. That story would be great to, one thing I'd say is it's really inspirational that you, I think for a lot of people that you, you start with music and you were working on that, and then you sort of were, wandering, right? You weren't exactly, playing as much, or, you knew you could have been, but you weren't. So you were in Seattle, and that's where that, maybe after some aspect, some time of idleness, then you, this breakthrough happened where you're playing 3 hours a day. And so I think that's really inspirational for a lot of people, because I think when it comes, many things in life, but I'll just use, music as a metaphor for all of it. There's things we have interest in, and especially as we live a little while, we realize that you might have a passion that's important to you, but you might drop it for a decade. You might let it go for 10 years and, like your guitar is in the closet and you haven't played it, but it doesn't mean that, it's not time to start all that time has an importance to it that you weren't playing. You know what I mean? And so when you weren't playing, maybe you had some idleness or like you knew you could be playing more. Like, what do you think happened in that? I'll call it a void between like your breakthrough in Seattle and when maybe like your playing trailed off a little bit.
That was just enjoying life a little bit. I went to India.
Oh, wow.
3 months. I delivered pizza for a while, just kind of hanging out and just having a good time. But San Francisco was really hard, and I had a great time. I learned a lot, but I just couldn't survive there. And Seattle was just just a better place for me at the time. And I was able to kind of regroup. I was regrouping and getting some, I was in a band in California for 6 years and we split up, and then I tried to do electronic music by myself, and I wasn't really getting anywhere in the Bay Area. And then I went to Seattle and everything sort of just kind of was more relaxed for me. And I was able to get in the studio more. I was able to start working on, I was really into electronic music in that early 2000s. I was just, I tell people I didn't have a piano for 18 years, but I had keyboards, but I didn't have a real piano in my life for 18 years. But in 2000, that's a whole other story.
What's that story? Yeah.
Well, I had made this, I'd made lots of music on my computer and electronic music. And I had a friend who was suicidal and he went to the hospital, and I said, well, I'm going to make him a CD of my music. So I made him a CD and I brought it to him, and it helped him get out of his depression. And he was so touched by the fact that I did that, that he got himself better to a point where he could, be back in the world again. And he decided that since I had done that for him, he wanted to give back to me. And he got a bunch of friends in the community and they all bought me a piano.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then from there, I started teaching piano a little bit and then teaching more and started playing more. And I started studying Chopin, like you were talking about earlier, about, bringing your guitar out of the closet and playing something. I started, connecting with an artist. It's exactly right. I started studying Chopin like crazy. I just couldn't get enough Chopin. I played all the nocturnes and started playing the waltzes, and getting a piano was kind of a breakthrough as well. And that was around 2006. So I started getting really good at piano again, playing the piano, like just literally playing the piano. And then, so that kind of led to 2010, where I started playing for dance classes.
Wow. Well, something about the piano is, like a real piano is, it's analog. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's so much of life is digital, and electronic music is just fine, but there is something to the organic experience, to the analog experience. Actually, the piano vibrates. It has a smell. It's like a living being. Would you say?
Yes. Yeah. They sing. They all have their own voice, and some pianos sing better than others. I connect with certain pianos, and I love to see where you can, where does that piano sing? How can you make it sing? They all have I agree with you. They're alive. Yeah.
And it seems like that's the case for instruments. Like it can, one piano, a different piano, one guitar, one drum, a different drum. They all will inspire you with their voice to play something you haven't played before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so then 2010 comes, and and that was a breakthrough. And so you really were just, what happened during those, 3 hours a day of improvising?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what was that breakthrough? What was happening?
I was getting paid to practice. It was great. I mean, it was a dream to be able to do that. I think, I feel that. And it was a great opportunity. I was playing for dancers. I'd never done that before. And my first actual ballet class was a train wreck. But that's just part of the process, right? It's part of the process of you have to dive, you have to dive into it. And I would say after about a year, I started getting really good. And I actually preferred playing for modern dance, but I was I was better at ballet, so he put me in all the ballet classes for most of that time. I would get a modern class here and there, and
it seems like one of the things like that you were doing is you were, you know, improvising for 3 hours a day, and that seems like.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh yeah. So you were when you say improvising, you were, well, I guess just exactly that. You were improvising, right? You were just playing some kind of rhythm and just going with it.
Yeah. And it goes back to just being able to hear it, and it just comes through me. But there was a combination of that and then learning the structures of harmony that I was studying music theory, and it was hands-on study.
Yeah.
It was like, just, you can study it on paper as much as you want, but when you're playing it on the piano, even, it's just the ultimate way, I think, to study harmony. And I don't feel like I've learned it all. I feel like there's more to learn.
Well, it seems like that's one of the things in learning that I think so many people are looking for, and it's one of the things that discourages, I think, maybe even most people, I would say, is, I probably shouldn't say most, I'll say a good deal of people, is I think they would like to do that, because I think one of the things that is very boring is learning music that exists. So especially when you're just starting, like on guitar, if you're just learning like Smoke on the Water or something like that, like one of those first songs, you know, mm-hmm. What if you could care less about that song? What if Deep Purple completely doesn't move you, and that rhythm is just, you're not interested. I mean, I know it's learning, but, and it, there's a value to it, but it seems that, like, the great music teacher would find out what interests the person, mm-hmm. and let them find that chord progression or help them find it, you know? And then from there, begin to work that melody with it, you know, show them, well, here's the scale to go with it, or scales or something, like give them a little bit of a framework, and then teach them, help them understand the music theory of what they're doing, and then let the person just play and improvise and hack away and make music, you know, find things. It just seems like that's something I think so many people are looking for, but a lot of music teachers, you might say, are just teaching. It's just a matter of just memorizing stuff, mm-hmm. that you play again that doesn't interest you, and then next week you start something else that doesn't interest you.
Right. Well, I was a piano teacher for 10 years or more, mm-hmm. In Seattle, and what I would tell my students was, first of all, it's a lifelong journey. There's no end. You get to start now and you get to do it for the rest of your life. That's if you want. But yeah, you have to have fun. And one of the things is, yeah, it's weird, is like, so you play, like, let's say you play a middle C and you're learning piano and it says C, and you write a little C on there, or you get a sticker that says C, or this is an A. That's not going to help you with playing the music, like knowing what that is. Like, I'll come across kids here in Santa Fe. There's a kid that just knows how to play. Like, she just goes up to the piano and she starts to play. She doesn't know what she's doing. And I think that's right there. That's the key, is you're not trying to label it, or you're listening. You're hearing it. I don't know how to teach it. I tried. I mean, I do. That's how I had some students. I could teach them that way. But a lot of people, they just want to know where's C and where's G, and it's not. That's secondary to the music, I think.
And well, that's a very different approach, and that's one, you know, like I'll say, here in the Western world, and probably the whole world, but definitely in the Western world, you know, it reminds me of like martial arts, like when karate came to the US, you know, would have been around 1970 or so before then, but really it's when it was tailored to the Western school, what the culture here liked. That's where you see a lot of the belts, you know, and that's where you see like breaking boards and things like that, because all that existed, you know, where karate came from. But you know what the Western mind wanted achievements, like, well, how long does it take to get a black belt, they would say, you know, like, and that was more of a Western version of it. And it's fine because it actually does work. There's a lot of value in that. But like, I think the idea of, you know, learning to hear, to feel, and to play the music, and to some extent ignoring middle C, that whole approach is I think a little bit foreign to the, I'll just call it the right. Western mind, you know, that's not so much like achievement based learning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, it's hard to tell somebody, you know, like, well, how long till I can, you know, play Mozart, you know, it's like, sure. Well, first you got to feel it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, play it. So I get it. That would be quite the, I think that's something a lot of people are looking for, is that kind of a ability to learn music, which I just think is, I don't think a lot of people are teaching it like that. I mean, I almost wish there was, you know, not just individual teachers, but maybe like music schools, you might say, that were taking that approach.
Right. Well, you do have to learn, I guess you do have to learn the basics, you know, in order to communicate with other musicians, if you want. I think learning tonal relationships, like knowing what a major chord is, what it sounds like, how the left hand supports the right hand, things like that. There's a lot to learn. And which is why when I was teaching, I was always trying to make it fun, so people would want to continue to study it. But yeah, you do have to learn kind of the basic things, but not, you can't do it in 6 months. I had a few students that wanted to. one of the things I've been exploring a lot is how the different placement of the left hand. If you take like a C major triad, you have C, E, and G. And what if you instead, the left hand would normally just play a C to support the right hand. So it would just, I should have my piano on, but I don't. But you know, the left hand could play any of those three notes. It could play an E. Like, what does that sound like if you're playing an E in the left hand instead of the C? Or what if you're playing the G underneath the C chord? Or what if you play a different note? Like, it's just listening to how different notes work with each other. And you can start, maybe, perhaps you'll find your own voice there. I try to find my voice in that.
Hmm. I like that. Look, yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, finding your, looking for your voice, feeling for mm-hmm. it, you know, feeling for your voice in that, you know. Yeah, that's the truth. I mean, we all need to learn the you know, music theory and the technical skill, work on that. I mean, of course, like, you know, I like, you know, playing guitar, and the thing is you need to get to that point where you're not looking at your left hand, you know, like where you just know where the strings are, where the notes are. That's almost like step one in some ways, because you know, you need to just know, you know, what octave you're in. You need to know. It's almost like, and it almost seems like, wow, that just couldn't be possible when you first start, but it will flow pretty quickly you know, and then you're no longer looking at the neck of your guitar and your fingers when you're playing things. Mm-hmm. And that's like a huge step right there, because now whatever music theory you know, you can start to play without having to look at it. Mm-hmm. And it, like right there, there's this threshold that gets passed, which is, I think, a real breakthrough, you know? So yeah, it's the
unlearning of it. It's the unlearning. It's where you have to just forget about it. And so how long have you been playing guitar?
Oh gosh. Off and on since like forever, I guess. I'm
right.
Like,
okay. So you understand it's the journey.
Yeah. That
guitar is the journey, playing in, and there's always something to learn, right?
Yeah, always something to learn. And like for me, that's one of the things, you know, I've ignored it in the closet for years, many times, you know, and even that sounds weird, but it's a rewarding experience because you come back to it. And I've even done things like work with other instruments just to almost avoid it, because you know, like you know, work with the harmonica for a while. Okay, this is fun, you know, and then. Mm-hmm. I actually have tablas, you know, and I've, and that I truly enjoy. I mean, playing the tabla is really, it's an amazing two little drums. And I've been really fortunate to know some, you know, it's not exactly easy to learn tablas here in the States. I mean, but I found some amazing teachers. There was a tabla, I guess they call it like Tabla University in Seattle. You know, was a group. Oh yeah.
Zakir Hussain, wasn't it Zakir Hussain's school or no?
You know, I forget who the master was.
Yeah, I'm terrible with San Rafael, actually. I forget.
Yeah.
I studied a little bit of tabla, actually.
There you go. Yeah. So that there's all these, like, I'm not even sure if there's side roads, because they're like, it's a real journey to take for a while, but that's the thing. So yeah, it's like I say, it's inspirational, where I think, you know, the musician who hasn't gone in a straight line, you know, is always kind of inspirational, because you're right. It is this like lifelong journey, and it's going to stick with you, even if it's hiding in the closet. Like, you still know it's there. There's still this like relationship going on.
Yeah.
You can never escape your instrument.
Yeah.
Like, you can never escape yourself either. So you're kind of stuck with both yourself and your instrument.
Yeah. I wish I was a good piano tuner, because when my piano goes out of tune, then I start avoiding it.
Oh, wow.
So, it's funny that I should say that, because my neighbor is a piano tuner and he comes over and tunes my piano for free.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's great. It's amazing.
Well, I've always thought that like the piano tuner was an art. I've always thought that they're musicians, even if they aren't necessarily. Mm-hmm. I think they are, because I've always thought of it like the piano tuner as this like Gandalf figure that comes, this like mystical figure that comes and, you know, has all this arcane knowledge, and they kind of like drop little knowledge on you once in a while. You know, it's kind of like the hermit in the tarot, you know, comes with his light and his tuning kit and like, just like some wisdom just kind of resonates. It's almost like the piano will, there'll be this harmonic resonance between like the Gandalf that comes over and tunes your piano. And then like, when you play it, you feel that magic of this, like, arcane sage that comes and tunes your, you know, piano. I may be making way more out of it than it really is, but in my mystical world, that's what a piano tuner is.
Yeah, I can kind of see that, what you're saying. My current piano tuner can literally tune my piano in like half an hour, which I am amazed, because most piano tuners take an hour and a half, and he just comes in and, oh, he's like, oh, it's not bad. And then he tunes it. And yeah. Mm.
Well, I tell you, people who have, what is it called? Like perfect, who like don't need a tuning fork. What do they call it? Like
perfect pitch.
Well, yeah. Perfect pitch. They've always pissed me off. So Like, just because that is, now there's an amazing, now there's like something to, that could almost be a journey in itself, just learning perfect pitch. Like, if you know, because like for me, I'll admit, I mean, I have a little, you know, snark on my guitar, and I have like, you know, I, like without electric tuner, I'd be out of luck. You know, yeah. I know it sounds good when it's tuned, and I love the sound. And then of course you can, especially on the guitar, you can tune to a 432, right. And that, oh my gosh, it just, there's a point to that for sure. I mean, a guitar tuned in 432 is a whole world. It's really a better sound, I think. Mm. But to tune my guitar in 432 without an electronic tuner, forget it. But maybe that path of getting that perfect pitch where I could tune at 440 and like 432 just with my, you know, just hearing it, you know, how can I just tune into C or A and just adjust the string to that? That, there you go. Maybe I'll start that journey. That would be an incredible thing.
Yeah. My tuner said he could do that for me. He's like, if you want, I could tune it to 432 if you want.
Oh, do it. Do if you want.
Should I try it? Maybe I should.
Try it. Oh my gosh. I tuned my guitar to it and I realized that I felt better when I played it. It's like, yeah, it's almost like the 440 tuning has a certain harshness to it that I never really realized. It's almost like a little... I can't quite describe it. But you go to 432 and to me it feels way more inviting. And it has a certain deeper kind of growl to it. It has a deeper, it's almost like you can feel the wood of the guitar. You can feel deeper into the wood of the guitar at 432, you know? Yeah. So if you'll tune it to 432, yeah, give it a try. Because then you'll put your next CD out.
Okay.
432, the black keys.
For sure. Well, maybe both black and white keys.
Yeah, black and white keys at 432. You know?
But it doesn't really have the same effect with digital instruments because now I'm curious to try it.
I don't know. You know, I have not tuned an electric guitar, even though the electrics would too, or can be. And a good electric guitar, you can certainly hear it. I've only tuned acoustic to 432, but yeah it's definitely worthwhile. I don't know, on an acoustic instrument I would say, you know, something that's it's definitely worth a check out, you know. It's definitely something amazing. Because I always heard, you know, there's a guy called it's called What Lurks Beneath he's got a YouTube channel. And he just does the most interesting topics. Usually they're like, all kinds of crazy topics. But one was 440 versus 432. And he's a musician. And he really breaks down the technology of it. Like, here's from the music theory perspective. And looks at it a bunch of different ways. I'll send you a link to the YouTube. Okay. And that inspired me. I was like, I have got to check this out, you know. And so that was quite the, that's been quite the inspirational journey. So yeah, just learning that perfect pitch and being able to tune, that would be, well, there you go, maybe I'll be inspired to do that. Like, where will that take a person? Just that, you know.
Well, I have something interesting to say about that.
Yeah,
I don't really have perfect pitch. I could come close if I'm just, you know, randomly in a room and somebody plays a note. I can usually come close, but when I sit at the piano, I suddenly have it and I can hear it and I know where A is, I know where C is. It just kind of, I don't know why, it's really a strange experience. And when I just sit down, I know where an A chord, I know I can hear it, or I can, what I hear in my head, I know where it is on the piano. So it's kind of like perfect pitch, but not quite.
yeah I think perfect pitch is hard. Just that alone, you know, is an art, is an aspect of musicianship, I think. That's why I always see the piano tuner as, you know, Gandalf, pretty much.
Right.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, well, the way I was introduced to your, you know, music, you know, we actually interviewed Stephen Halpern. And
I saw that.
Yeah, and so that was quite the experience to get the patriarch of new age music on, you know. And this amazing, and I have another one that you've done too, and I don't know which one that was called.
Elation.
Yeah. And so this is very cool. So you got hooked up with the Monroe Institute, and then your music is on the CD, and along with that you've got, they have Hemisync playing. Mm-hmm. And so I'd love to know like how that connection happened. Mm-hmm. and what it was like to create this, and you know, how involved were you with the Hemisync track that's in this?
I didn't have a lot of involvement with the Hemisync technology side of it.
Mm-hmm.
My goal was to create a beautiful journey of music for them to have, to put the Hemisync underneath it. And how did Stephen Halpern lead you to that CD?
Well, you know, it's because he did, well, of course he has like, I don't know what, like 900 albums, and then like 1,000 that he's forgotten about that he's created. You know what I mean? And he did an album with the Monroe Institute. I think it's called like Sacred Journeys, and it has a Hemisync track. You know, it's all Hemisync under it, you know, or Hemisync with it. And then I've always had an interest in just the Hemisync itself, the albums from the Monroe Institute, you know, which will like take me a lifetime to get through all the meditation in them, you know. But in looking at when I found out about Stephen Halpern's album, I was listening to that. But then also I got a few more that were there at the Hemisync site, that I guess the Monroe Institute, it belongs to them, I think, the Hemisync site. And I found yours, you know, and I liked it, and there's some samples. And so just I've really been finding that, you know, in meditation, you know, I like what Hemisync can do, but it doesn't even have to, but that's optional. You know, one can certainly listen to, have Hemisync going, but also just, you know, music itself, of course. But, you know, to me, what I liked about, you know, Breakthrough was just, it was good to meditate to, or good to do things to, you know, it was good for like activity or not activity. You know, I think I've been recently just looking for, you know, sound to meditate to. And because you can get, at least for me, silence is great, but something that I think still is in the works, and maybe I'll end up, you know, creating some of my own for this actually, is, you know, I think the world really needs meditation music, you know, and not just like way too much of it is a little bit too crystal bowl-y. It's boring, you know, a lot of it. Like, I think that, you know, it'd be great if there was a, like a series of like meditation music, you know, tracks, like, each could be, you know, quite long or not, that were for different, you might say, purposes, you know, like what if one just wanted to have like soul connection, inspiration, meditation, you know, like, and that was like you mentioned. So the musician sort of focuses on just that feeling and then improvises and plays. But then especially like with the Hemisync thrown in, which can have frequencies that match that, you know. So anyway, that's kind of my quest these days, is to find and or create anyway more like specific purpose meditation, you know, because I think that sound can really do a lot for meditation.
Right.
It really can do a lot for meditation. And I think that, you know, we're all only kind of scratching the surface of what we can do with sound when it comes to meditation. Even though I know a lot's been done, I just have this feeling that there's something emerging that at least I know is there, and I'll find and or create, probably end up finding some of it and creating more of it. Anyway, that was like what I was working on, or you know, when I found your CD.
Right. Well, yeah, music to me is meditation.
Yeah.
It's kind of goes back to what I said about taking about an hour for me to really drop in.
Yeah.
So you have to be committed to it, devoted to it. And it's sort of the next step of my life, where why I left Seattle and what some of my goals have been and that I'm still working towards. So when I was in Seattle playing for 3 hours at a time,
yeah,
I was like, wow, I should do this all the time. I should play the piano all the time. So I started going a little bit away from electronic production and more just to the piano. And so, you know, we decided to leave and come to Santa Fe. And I was thinking, I just want to get the piano set and record it and just start playing and play for 3 hours a day or 3 hours at a time, and put out a piano podcast, you know, where it's just piano music for 3 hours every time I do it and just put it out there. And it's still kind of out there as an idea, and it hasn't really fully manifested, because the first one I did, it was in 2020, and I just played and played and played, and I recorded and recorded and recorded, and then that ended up becoming an album instead of a podcast. So I don't know if my perfectionist side kicked in and I wanted to edit it and everything and kind of make it sound better. And I don't know. So how I'm still kind of figuring out, how can I just play for 3 hours, stop recording, and then just put it up into the world?
That's one of the things about, you know, live streaming is, well, it's easy, you know, on YouTube, it's easy. Is it easy? Yeah, sure. It's easy enough, you know? Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about live streaming is it's this little bit of pressure, because I find that, here's the thing: when you live stream, so if you go, okay, I'm gonna have my YouTube channel, and I'm going to, you know, maybe aim a little webcam at the keyboard, and I'm just going to start playing. Well, if you go like, okay, like you title your video, whatever, like the date, whatever, maybe what you're thinking, something, and you just start live streaming, and you know, they can see your fingers or maybe not, whatever. See, you're live. That's the thing. And so you kind of have to keep going. And if you make mistakes, you make mistakes. Or you know what I mean? Where if we record something, I think so many things that get recorded never get released. Like perfection kills them. But the thing about live streaming is you just like, if you hop on every day or whenever whenever it's in your schedule and you just hit the live button and you just play, well, then it's funny, but I think you might find yourself back in Seattle at the dance studio because you got to play, like, there you are. You know, you didn't really have much choice. You had to keep going. And so when you're live streaming, even though it's going out, it's live, it's going to be recorded, it's there, you know, it's alive and there it is, you know. So it stays there after the fact, people can listen to it, of course, but you're live, like you're back in the dance studio. And, I find it to be like for me doing podcasts, you know, I found that, you know, to be live is 1,000% better than recording it and then uploading it. you know? And like I don't really work on a live audience that much. I kind of need to. So our live audience is also this podcast we're doing now is a little bit unannounced, you know? Life's been a little bit too crazy recently. Mm-hmm. And so I just did not, you know, put it out like I usually do. So like there's, you know, like I can look at the little stream, it's like really nobody there, but it doesn't really matter because the views come afterwards, mostly for this little podcast that we do. But even if you're live streaming to like six people or zero people or whatever, you're still live, you know, it's right. I find it to be great. I think if you started live streaming, you would find that like it was almost like you had a show to do every day. Oh, I gotta go live. I gotta get on. You know?
Yeah, I agree. I'll have to start doing it.
Yeah, because it's so neat because you're live streaming to like the whole yeah. world. You know, it's neat. It really is like plugging into the consciousness and just playing, and then whoever, you know, resonates with it will hear it, whether they're in, you know, South Africa, right. you know, Brazil, Antarctica. It doesn't really matter, you know. Right. And that's really neat. That's really fun to do. Well, let's see, I've had you for a while. I mean, let's see. I think we covered a lot of ground, and you know, I'm going to like real quick, I'm just going to share the screen again here just so people can see, you know, you've got mechalmiracle.com, and the nice thing is you've got lots of great stuff right here that people can listen to. It's wonderful. And of course there's your Spotify, lots of content there. And then this is your, let's see, I thought I saw somewhere. Yeah, Breakthrough for Peak Performance. So over here on your Spotify, you've got a long track. Actually, it's like, I think it was like 44 minutes. And then Elation. So they're there. You know?
Right.
I mean, so, you know, there you go, people. You can listen to Breakthrough for Peak Performance and Elation.
Or you can listen to my new stuff, too. I've been making... I have like five... full-length albums. I just released one last year that's called Light.
Where is that one? Light. It's there, right, Light. Yeah. So yeah, you can hear the so if you're interested in Hemi Sync very specifically, it's there. It's also Light, like you say, something recent is there. So that's wonderful. You have a great you know, accomplishment of recordings here. And so definitely, I mean, I'll have to catch up on some of these. I've really listened to your, you know, Breakthrough. That's kind of been my real intro to what you've created. And so you've got even more out there.
Yeah.
There's a Bandcamp page you've got with content there, Facebook. And so, you know, you've got it together, you know.
Yeah. And that's just half of what I do.
Half what you do. What's the other half?
Well, I do lots of things. I'm a music director for a statewide dance school here called National Dance Institute of New Mexico, and we serve 9,000 kids all over the state, all into even the smallest little towns that, you know, don't have exposure to the arts. And we go in. Our flagship schools are in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, and I'm the director of music director of the whole organization. And so I oversee all the musicians and make sure they're all going out to the right places and we're playing music for the dance classes. And it's great. It's a great organization. And it's just great to be doing music to helping kids, you know, and especially when we go into these small towns where they don't get exposure to the arts, and they can see this, you know. They get to take a dance class. They get to learn about core values. We have core values that we teach the kids, working hard, being healthy, never give up, doing your best.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
They've dialed it in to amazing, to a science, we like to say. And it's just, I don't know. It's a very rewarding work. And I'll get to go into these little towns in New Mexico and, they're like, wow, his piano, you know, piano player, and he's, you know. And so inspiring kids, you know, it's important, you know, it's really important, I feel.
Yeah, because that's the thing, you never really know where that inspiration is going to go. Inspiration is like this real energy and a substance all its own, and then a person has that inspiration and, you know, it's like lightning, you know, it's going to ground somewhere, and it'll ground somewhere positive, wherever that might be, I think, mm-hmm. you know. That's remarkable stuff to be doing. Well, so you were living in Seattle. Now you're in New Mexico. Do you miss the lush wonderland of the Pacific Northwest, or did you not like the rain so much?
Do I miss the rain?
Yeah. Well, the rain is unique, you know.
I grew up in California, and where it's the weather's always nice.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Always, but most of the time. And so when I first moved to Seattle, I was kind of cursing the weather for a couple of years, but I got used to it. And it's beautiful up there. It's very green and lush. Santa Fe is the opposite. It's sunny all the time.
Yeah.
And I love that. I just love the sun.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, here in Arizona, here in the Sonoran Desert, you know, it's not like New Mexico for sure. It's different, but it's kind of like living in a blast furnace. You know? I mean, like the UV here is extreme during the height of the sun, and, you know, but it's beautiful. Like I like the lush, beautiful Pacific Northwest. Like the background here is actually a trail up Tiger Mountain over in Issaquah in the Pacific Northwest.
That's Tiger Mountain.
That's Tiger Mountain. Yeah, right.
That's where I proposed to my wife.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So yeah, this is Tiger Mountain. So this is one of the trails up.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I love going there.
Yeah. So there's Tiger Mountain, you know, that's where we did this interview in Tiger Mountain here on the trail leading up to at the beginning. And well, that's just great. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're digging the sun there in New Mexico. You know, definitely it took me a couple of years to get acquainted to kind of acclimate, but now I'm digging the sun too. I'm digging the sun, the heat. It was like over 100 the other day, and somebody was commenting like, oh, you know, it's so hot in the sun. And I just like, I realized, I was like, I like it now. I don't even think about it. I really don't.
I was thinking that you must get used to it. And you start.
You do.
Yeah. Like, because I've been down there a couple times a year.
And yeah.
I've been there when it's like 113. And
yeah. It's glorious. You start to just like it. It's so strange, but you go out there, you're like, ah, yeah, this is nice. Cause you know, the heat and the desert, it's very truthful. Like the big saguaros, they're these big, like scalar antennas they're really mystical, cactus. And so there's really unique energy, here in the Sonoran Desert. So might not be my forever home. I really doubt that, but I would say that there's an energetic, ruthless truth to the place. It's so hot, and there's so much like just energy. The quartz content under like Phoenix, Scottsdale area here, all the way up to Sedona. Then there's the Moses up there in Sedona. There's so much quartz content in under the ground that actually creates this big toroidal energy between here and the ionosphere. So actually you're living in like a cosmic energy supercharge here, you know, and a blast furnace. If you're into like pottery, you can just put your nice new creation on the hood of your car and it will be hardened. you don't even need a kiln here. Just put it on the hood of your car and park it outside. Wow. Well, Michael Miracle, it has been great talking to you. It's really been inspirational. You know, I love like kind of getting into seeing, you know, your world and what you're about. And, you know, I was introduced to you from this cool album, and, you know, I'm glad that you're still creating stuff and there's more to come, and you're, involved in such cool stuff there in New Mexico. So, I mean, it's been great talking to you. I mean, any closing thoughts, any like inspiration for musicians out there?
Any artist?
Yes. Any artist. Yeah.
Be in service. That's how you will find your bliss. Do what you love and serve humanity, or serve the world, and you'll find success. That's what I learned.
Oh, I like it. I like it. And you're definitely there. Wow. Yeah. Well, I will check in on you again in some time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And see, like, all right, you know, what's going on? And I'm sure they'll be like, wow, you know. I think there's still just, I can sense there's still much more to come.
Thank you for reaching out, and I really appreciate meeting you and talking to you, and I'll let you know when I get start doing the piano podcast thing.
Oh yeah. Absolutely do. That would be so great. Yeah. Well, take care. And it's Radiant Creators, you know, signing off. And of course, Michael Miracle, that is, just in case you are listening and you haven't already typed that in, it's Michael Miracle, michaelmaricle.com. And we'll talk to you again. We're going to check up on you again and see what other miraculous stuff you're achieving. So take
care. Please do. Yeah. Thank you, and take care.
You too.
All right.
Bye. Bye.